Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the rather cumbersomely named programme whose unrelenting focus is the response of our species to the climate emergency. It is often said that we know what we need to do, but that the political will to do what is necessary is lacking. In the face of institutional inertia and the stalling tactics of vested interests, many people who are concerned about climate change are turning to direct action in order to give fresh impetus to political action. With this year's Camp for Climate Action in London, less than 4 weeks away, we thought we'd revisit our report on last year's camp. It provides a window on the gaping gulf between mainstream reporting on the event and the reality of the camp itself. And we'll follow this later in August with some interviews with participants from this year's upcoming camp. So cast your mind back, if you will, as we rewind the clock 12 months to August 2008.
Most were detained for obstructing the police. They opposed plans to expand the plant. 123 people had to be rescued from the River Medway after taking to small boats. Four people managed to get inside the perimeter. Officials said electricity output was unaffected.
The third Camp for Climate Action in the UK has just come to an end. If you watched the main BBC news bulletin on Saturday the 9th of August, you might have got the impression that this protest over government plans to build a new series of coal-fired power stations, starting with King's North in Kent, was of little significance. After all, the story was allocated the briefest of mentions, a mere 20 seconds in a bulletin that lasted 20 minutes. You might have got the impression the public order had been ruptured temporarily by a group of misguided protesters, but the order had been safely restored by a benign police force, even if those images of baton-threatening mounted police did look a little worrisome. And yet, if only the BBC had given a little context. The battle over King's North is actually about the crossroads that the UK finds itself at in terms of its electricity provision. Are we going to focus on energy efficiency and renewable energy and meet our carbon reduction targets? Or are we going to continue to be pushed around by the vested interests of the fossil fuel and nuclear lobbies and lock ourselves in to expensive high carbon futures? But more than that, it's about whether or not Prime Minister Gordon Brown chooses a path that could represent a tipping point in the way the world responds to global warming. The situation was laid bare last December when one of the world's leading climate scientists, James Hansen, wrote in a personal capacity to the Prime Minister, asking him to show, quote, bold leadership that could change the course of human history, unquote. He suggested that because Great Britain, the US and Germany have contributed most to the fossil fuel carbon dioxide that remains in the atmosphere today on a per capita basis, we have, quote, a responsibility to lead in finding a solution to global warming, unquote, and that if Great Britain and Germany halted construction of coal-fired power plants that do not capture and sequester CO2, it could be a tipping point for the world. The importance of this juncture has been recognised not only by the campaigners at the Camp for Climate Action and Professor James Hansen, but also by the massive coalition of NGOs under the banner of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, which represents over 70 organisations ranging from the Ramblers Association to Islamic Relief, with a combined membership of over 4 million people. Back in February, the Prince of Wales gave a speech at the European Parliament where he asked, can we possibly allow 20 years of business as usual before coal generation becomes clean? Are we truly investing enough in renewables? Then in April, the Royal Society, the UK's leading scientific institution, wrote to Gordon Brown, warning that if fossil fuels, particularly coal, were allowed to dominate new electricity production, then it will make meeting our domestic and international climate change targets much harder. At the end of July, the House of Commons Environment Audit Committee completed their look at King's North and concluded as follows. replacing old coal-fired power stations with new ones rather than using alternative energy sources, locks Britain into a high level of emissions for many years to come. The increased efficiency of new plants is nowhere near enough to make unabated coal an environmentally acceptable choice. Any alternative form of electricity generation would provide significantly more substantial emissions reductions. An early day motion has been signed by 228 members of Parliament, which calls for a public inquiry into King's North in relation to its impact on climate change. And, as the protesters were setting up camp, the government's former chief scientific adviser, Sir David King, warned that a return to coal-fired power risked returning the planet to a pre-ice age era when the Antarctic was a tropical forest. Hardly a fringe issue then. The good news is that we are at a crossroads in the UK. Over the next decade or so, our ageing coal plants and nuclear plants are set to close, so we could choose to switch much of our electricity generation to renewable sources. Timed to coincide with the start of the camp, Greenpeace and WWF UK published some new research which they commissioned from the same energy consultants used by the Department for Business. Poirier Energy Consulting's report concludes that if the government keeps to its National Energy Efficiency Action Plan and our European commitment to produce 15% of our total energy from renewable sources by 2020, then there is no need for new nuclear or coal-fired generation during that period. And the Centre for Alternative Technologies' Zero Carbon Britain report has calculated that with additional demand management policies and infrastructure investment, we could power Britain entirely from renewable energy and reduce our emissions to zero within 20 years. The Minister for Energy, Malcolm Wicks, and the narrow set of business interests that he is defending are looking increasingly isolated and their position increasingly indefensible. The Stop Climate Chaos Coalition argue that we should act boldly and, quote, invest in developing a strong, homegrown, renewable energy industry and send a strong signal to the international community that the UK is prepared to help lead the transition to a low-carbon future for our world. As the leading environmental groups are now arguing, Gordon Brown has the option of introducing a legal greenhouse gas standard for electricity generation, a measure introduced by Arnold Schwarzenegger in California and already supported by the Conservative and Liberal Democrats here in the UK, which would rule out new coal-fired electricity generation unless it is equipped with full carbon capture and storage technology from the outset. It's about 3:10 on Wednesday morning, and this is the second time that the police helicopter has flown over on a continual basis for about 15 minutes with a kind of 10 minute lapse in between, and they did the same thing yesterday morning. Seems like a kind of bizarre experiment in sleep deprivation. Heavy-handed policing of the site this year, it seems. This year's Camp for Climate Action was another fantastic organisational achievement and is now part of a burgeoning worldwide network of climate camps. Alongside the usual sustainable infrastructure needed to maintain a low-impact temporary autonomous zone for between 1,500 and 2,000 people, such as compost loos, running water, catering with local organic vegan food, washing facilities, communal meeting spaces, site security and communications, first aid, media liaison, renewable energy generation and distribution across the whole site, recycling, composting, and a team of legal observers. This year, the camp also managed to provide enough solar power to run its own radio and TV stations. The camp provided an opportunity to discuss all the issues around climate change, from its disproportionate impact on countries of the global south, to international policy options, the problems of carbon trading, the role of direct action, the role of the state, alternative energy options, and so on and so forth. This year, camp organisers had gone out of their way to address concerns from trade unionists about the campaign against coal's possible effect on jobs. They issued a statement about the need for a just transition, which would ensure that the needs and concerns of any workers affected would be addressed. Just transition is a concept that is also being developed by the TUC. The National Union of Mine Workers leader, Arthur Scargo, responded to the camp's open letter to the unions and came down to engage in discussion with the camp. Scargill has said that he sympathises with the protesters and with their fight for what they believe in, but understandably perhaps, he has some way to go before he drops his support for the coal industry's idea that coal can be clean. And yet, most of the vast majority of new coal mines opening, or threatening to open in the UK, are of the open cast strip mining varieties, which besides being highly destructive to the landscape, employ relatively few people operating large machines. The police did their best to sap and divert the constructive energies of the camp in what has been widely condemned as a heavy-handed operation. Police tactics included a blanket stop-and-search operation and two aggressive invasions of the site, which were caught on camera by mainstream news reporters and witnessed by Norman Baker MP. The incursions included what a camp press release described as an extraordinary mass seizure of personal property on an almost unprecedented scale. Items confiscated included site vehicles, food supplies, materials for site infrastructure, bicycles, and soap. It seemed to be a specific aim of the police operation to disrupt the sleep patterns of participants by both engineering the threat of further dawn raids by riot police throughout the week and by low-flying helicopters over the site at around 3 o'clock most mornings. The overhead helicopter also frequently disrupted workshops and speeches by invited guests during the daytime. A camp spokesperson said that their legal team would be exhausting every possible channel for holding the police accountable for actions which are believed to be illegal under UK law, as well as in breach of various articles of the European Convention on Human Rights. Caroline Lucas MEP and the MPs Norman Baker and Colin Challon, who all participated in the camp, have written a joint letter to the commander of Kent Police, outlining a number of serious concerns about a police response which they describe as disproportionate, arbitrary, destructive, and aggressive. Just how far up the chain of command was the decision made to police the camp in this manner? An operation, after all, which involved 26 police forces, over 1,500 police, and costs of several million pounds. According to the camp website, a report in local newspaper The Medway Messenger said that the Home Office will be paying for 90% of the police's costs. The camp website, therefore, reaches the conclusion that, quote, the decision on the level of policing and the highly politicised style of policing was decided by central government some time ago and not local Kent Police. Despite all this, a wave of non-violent direct actions unfolded throughout the week, which served to highlight the role of some of the key players who are cashing in on climate change. The action started just as the camp was setting up on the 1st of August, at the offices of the multinational agribusiness Cargill, who were targeted for their role in accelerating climate change, rainforest destruction, land grabbing, and profiteering from the food crisis through their biofuels operations. 20 activists closed down the company's European head office in Surrey by blocking vehicle access. The press release for the action included three powerful letters and testimonies from communities directly affected by the company's actions in Brazil, Paraguay, and Papua New Guinea. The agri-fuels industry was targeted again later in the week by an action at Vopak, the biggest biofuel depot in the south of England. Here is an account of the action recorded by one of the activists.
This is Dean Rivers on behalf of Action Against Agri-Fuels. This morning on the 7th of August, we accessed the West Thurrock biofuel depot run by Greenergy at 8:45 in the morning, and we blocked the entrance road so that tankers couldn't enter or leave, and we also mounted the main silo and dropped a 40-foot banner before locking onto the stairwell. The intention was to last as long as we could. We were successful on both counts. On the road blockade, 8 people locked on using arm tubes. They remained in place for an hour and a half before police malhandled the group and caused so much distress the protesters were forced to break the link, and 5 out of the 8 were arrested. These heavy-handed tactics were picked up on camera. The police were completely unapologetic. There were serious breaches of health and safety, and on one occasion, blood was drawn from one of the protesters. On the stairwell, we managed to blockade for 5 hours, finishing at 2:15. There were 4 arrests after the D-locks were cut from the protesters. We felt forced to undergo this protest to draw attention to the severe impacts that large-scale agri-fuels are causing in a multitude of ways.
The Royal Bank of Scotland was also targeted 2 days in a row for their role in financing coal and fossil fuel developments. The first was a die-in by 15 students lying in pools of oil outside the company's headquarters in Liverpool Street. I spoke to the media rep for the group, Sam, about what happened on the second action.
Can you just describe what happened on the action?
4 of us were in London and we met up early in the morning about 8 o'clock to go to the Royal Bank of Scotland's oil and gas building, where they also do the financing for the coal industry. And we went there for about 8:30 in the morning. By 8:45, 2 of our group of 4 were superglued to door handles outside the office, not in fact blocking the main entrance, but just to the side with a banner in front of them. So we were there by 8:45 and sort of securely in place.
So how long were you there for, and what did you do whilst you were there?
We were there for around an hour and a half. We had this banner that said Royal Bank of Scotland cashing in on coal, and we had a leaflet which we'd prepared the night before, which explained what RBS in fact are doing, how they put money into E.ON, which is, you know, obviously there's the whole King's North issue, and then there's possibly other coal-fired power stations to come. So the idea was to inform both the workers at RBS, many who told us that they'd never heard anything about it, and also passers-by about exactly what RBS were doing in their role of funding E.ON and also other oil and gas projects.
So you're able to engage people in kind of conversation and debate as well?
Yeah, there were two glued on, as it were, and then the other two of us, one myself, I was sort of media talking to various people, and we had sort of a legal observer person to make sure the cops were behaving themselves, and yeah, also to chat to workers. We had quite a few good chats with people who worked there and people going past. We had sympathetic honks from truck and lorry drivers, and you know, managed to engage some cyclists for a short time at the crossroads where we were. So we did actually manage to get, you know, have quite a few good chats with people saying they were going to examine the websites that we linked to on the leaflet. So yeah, that was very positive.
And how did it all end?
The building security were with us within about 10 minutes, and the police turned up within about half an hour as everything was going fine. And then an inspector came along who seemed quite pressurising, really, and really sort of getting in our faces and, you know, warning us that we'd be arrested as it was private property if we didn't unglue ourselves. But obviously, we had no solvent. So what they did was they unscrewed the door handles that the people were glued to, and the two people were arrested for breach of the peace. But it was fairly obvious to us that no charges were going to be brought against them. It seemed as though Royal Bank of Scotland didn't really want any charges to be brought. As the day before, the People and Planet group had done a mass die-in outside the bigger headquarters just down the road, and no charges had been made against any of those. So we felt pretty confident that the two arrested people would be out quite soon. So they were taken just down the road to the small police station while the other two of us waited outside to support them and talk to the media and talk to the legal team back at the camp.
And they were released shortly after?
They were released, yeah, within about 2.5 hours.
Okay.
Not too long to wait in themselves, really.
Why do you think it's important to undertake this type of action as opposed to other types of campaigning?
We wanted to highlight that civil disobedience campaigns and direct action campaigns are necessary to highlight how, I think, personally, how important it is to some people, you know, what's going on. It stemmed from being at the camp and deciding that the mass day of action wasn't the right thing for our affinity group, which was quite newly formed, and, you know, it was a range of ages. So we wanted to do something visible and useful. We didn't want to get arrested just for trying to get through a fence and failing or whatever. So we wanted to do something where we could be positive and talk to people and get feedback, because it's a lot more rewarding than sort of facing off at the cops in a sort of the back of a power station, you know, where no one's watching. So for us, it was certainly a positive action.
What did you choose specifically to target RBS?
Royal Bank of Scotland has, in the last 2 years, invested over $7 billion in dollars into E.ON. So it's financed them. And there's no doubt that some of that money, or large chunks of it, will have gone into King's North and the whole King's North project. So essentially we wanted to draw attention, both for the public and for the workers, that this kind of thing was going on.
And it seems to be part of a kind of wider ongoing campaign against RBS and perhaps the threat of a boycott as well.
It has been mentioned, yeah. There's now an annual day of action, certainly in the UK, against Royal Bank of Scotland last year in October. Started by Rising Tide, and I think it will spread this year and get wider. So yes, there have been talks also of a boycott, very similar to how many students during the 80s boycotted Barclays because of their links with apartheid South Africa. So that has been discussed. At the moment, it's just it's just spreading the message about Royal Bank of Scotland, do what they do exactly. And if there's no change, perhaps a boycott will be called for. But that's something to think about in the future, really.
Okay.
The Royal Bank of Scotland is the second largest bank in Europe and now owns NatWest, Direct Line and Churchill Insurance. A new report called Cashing In on Coal has been published this week by a coalition of environmental groups and identifies RBS as having been involved in the greatest number of loans to companies engaged in the extraction and or combustion of coal. Up until recently, the company was styling itself as the Oil and Gas Bank, a branding decision which was hastily reversed after a campaign against them was launched. Another action that same day targeted the Department for Business in an audacious action involving a dozen naked protesters. Here's Dan Glass, a spokesperson for the group.
There was 13 naked protesters at the Department for Business, Enterprise and Regulatory Reform. We turned up at Victoria Street, where it's at about lunchtime, went up to the entrance, stripped off our clothes and put our placards on, which were all titled with the naked truth and had various different sayings underneath them, like E.ON sticks to dirty power, we stick to E.ON, that we can support clean, renewable energy and that we must keep fossil fuels in the ground. And we got up on top of the front of it and superglued ourselves to the front of the department and superglued ourselves to the sign, of the Department for Business, Enterprise and Regulatory Reform, and stayed there for about an hour and a half.
So which bit of your body was stuck? Was it your feet?
Or? It was our hands.
Your hands, okay.
Hands stuck to each other, stuck to the poles and stuck to the sign.
Okay. And it looked from the Channel 4 coverage that you were standing on rather cold granite or something.
Yes, it was quite cold, but the adrenaline was keeping us warm.
Right. So, I mean, to do it, you had to get round the security?
Well, the security were pretty lax, actually. I think they were chuckling away, and we disrupted some of the working folks. They were some of the workers came out and were just staring at what was going on, understandably. And then they eventually got us off, but no one got arrested.
How do you unstick yourself from each other?
Hot soapy water.
As simple as that, yeah?
Yeah, hot soapy water.
Okay.
The best way to get off super glue.
Okay. Why did you decide to take this action?
Well, the department for, it's called BERR, is the one which sanctions King's North Coal Fire Power Station. We'll basically sign on the dotted line. And the reason why we took it is because if we seriously want to tackle climate change, which we can in our window of opportunity, this isn't going to come about by burning fossil fuels when we have massive potential to invest in renewable energy. Coal is the largest contributor to the human-made increases of CO2 in the air. And King's North is just one of the first of the planned new generation of coal-fired power stations, which will emit around 50 million tonnes of CO2 a year. I mean, even James Hansen, the leading climate change scientist, who is the head of NASA, came out and sent a letter of support to the climate camp saying that King's North is a terrible idea and that one power plant with a lifetime of several decades will destroy the efforts of millions of citizens to reduce their emissions, and we have to invest in alternative renewable energy before it's too late. Particularly with the superglue, it seems to be coming the activist tool of late, which is quite exciting. And basically we're saying we have to stick to the facts of the climate change science. Climate change is not going anywhere, neither are we, and we're going to be coming back to E.ON if they continue to be going down the road of fossil fuels.
So can I ask you what happened afterwards? Was anyone arrested?
No one was arrested. We all just walked off. Well, after being unstuck, I was actually doing media naked on the day, which shocked some of the media outlets, but I still had a placard over myself, otherwise it would have been indecent exposure. But no, we ended up just walking off.
Is there anything else you want to say about it?
Well, there's that, and basically just saying with the whole of the climate camp that the government can't hide from opposition to fossil fuels anymore, and they're going to continue hearing why it's a devastating thing for both the planet and communities affected by climate change, and it's time that the government stood up to the bullies of the fossil fuel industry and stood up for the British public and for the planet as well, and we're going to continue coming back until we've had an adequate response to dealing climate change seriously.
The mass action itself involved a three-pronged approach. Around 1,000 people joined a colourful march along the roads to the power station. At around 1 p.m, a police helicopter circling above threatened to remove people who were still at the gates with horses and dogs. 100 others reached the power station's perimeter fence by travelling across fields. A number of these made it beyond the perimeter fence, and a handful of those made it beyond the second fence, an electric fence which had been turned off, before being arrested by police. And more than 120 people took to the river on a variety of boats, some homemade, before being arrested by the police. One of the waterborne crews, though, made it to an island opposite the power station and dropped a banner, and according to a police charge sheet, disrupted the running of the power station by causing the water inlet cooling system to be shut down. The campers spent the rest of the day celebrating their success. Over a year ago, on the 8th of July 2007, leading climate scientist Professor James Hansen wrote, "A moratorium on coal-fired power stations without carbon capture and storage should be the rallying issue for young people. It seems to me that they should be doing whatever is necessary to block construction of dirty coal-fired power plants. People are starting to rise to that challenge, and at the end of this year's Camp for Climate Action, protesters have been signing pledges to take more direct action in the event that a new coal-fired power station is given the go-ahead. The promise is to take action against E.ON and other companies until all such plans are abandoned." You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show, produced for Resonance FM in London, by Climate Radio. Thanks for listening.